Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, 8th Amendment and Victim Impact Evidence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On October 11, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Boss v. Oklahoma. In 1987, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Booth v. Maryland that the 8th Amendment prohibits a sentencing jury in a death penalty case from considering victim impact evidence that does not directly relate to the circumstances of the crime. 4 years later, in Payne v. Tennessee, the Supreme Court clarified that the ban only applied to certain kinds of victim impact testimony. Sean Michael Boss was convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder. The prosecution sought the death penalty and, over Boss's objection, asked 3 of the victim's family members to recommend a sentence to the jury. All 3 recommended the death penalty, and the jury sentenced Boss to death. Boss appealed, arguing that the testimony violated the 8th Amendment under Booth. The Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed, holding that Payne had implicitly overruled Booth's ban as it related to characterizations of the defendant and opinions about the sentence. By a vote of 8-0, the U.S. Supreme Court vacated the decision of the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals and remanded the case. The Supreme Court held in a per curiam opinion that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals erred in concluding that Payne had implicitly overruled Booth in its entirety. Supreme Court decisions remain binding precedent until reconsidered, the court explained, even when subsequent cases have raised doubts about their continuing vitality. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Alito joined. To discuss the case, we have Aaron Sheely, who is assistant professor at the University of Calgary Faculty of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Sheely.
On October 11, 2016, the Supreme Court held in a per curiam opinion that the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals erred in concluding that it was not bound by the Supreme Court's holding in Booth v. Maryland, which held that the 8th Amendment prohibits a capital sentencing jury from considering testimony by a victim's family members about the crime, the defendant, and the appropriate sentence. So just to generally describe what this sort of testimony normally would be, the category of victim impact evidence is presented at sentencing and contains impressions or reflections on the crime, the offense, the offender, by either the victim, if the victim has survived, or their family members. Usually this takes the form of what's called a victim impact statement, which is usually read aloud by the victim at trial. Occasionally it's submitted to the court in written form as part of the sentencing packet. And generally the idea is that it's supposed to provide the sentencing court, either judge or jury, with one metric for measuring the seriousness of an offense. Essentially, it's the idea that the victims, their experiences, the harm they have suffered as a result of the underlying offense should be taken into account for sentencing purposes in determining punishment. Now, victim impact evidence has been very controversial in the literature on sentencing. Proponents argue that it allows important narratives about the offense, about the victims, about their harm and the effects of the crime on them, important narratives that would otherwise be inaccessible to the fact finder, that would not have been part of the guilt phase of the trial and should be taken into account by the sentencer during sentencing. There's also a very popular argument that allowing victim impact evidence into the sentencing proceeding serves what's called a restorative function for victims. In other words, that there's a kind of therapeutic benefit to victims being able to tell their stories in open court, to confront the offender, to have sort of their day to participate in this process, and that this should be helpful for the purposes of healing and restoration. Opponents of victim impact evidence argue that it essentially injects inappropriate negative emotion into the proceedings at the expense of the defendant, that it's sort of the criminal process is already weighted against the defendant in a lot of ways, he's already been convicted, that it's sort of an inappropriate opportunity for additional negative emotion to just be piled on in a potentially prejudicial fashion. They also argue that victim impact evidence doesn't actually convey any useful information to the sentencing body because individual victim accounts might be wholly idiosyncratic. Therefore, it's kind of hard to place them when we're thinking about the various purposes that punishment is supposed to to secure. It's sometimes hard to figure out how victim impact evidence is directly relevant to any of these purposes. And critics also argue that victim impact evidence might result in asymmetrically high sentences in cases where the victims are either more articulate or in some way more relatable to either the judge or sentencing jury if it's a death case. So in Booth v. Maryland in 1987, the Supreme Court had originally held that the Eighth Amendment bars victim impact evidence, except for that which relates directly to the circumstances of the crime. So victims would be allowed under the Booth precedent to testify about what had actually happened during the crime itself, but not to sort of go on at length about their experiences, the aftermath, and so forth. A few years later, in 1991, the court decided Payne v. Tennessee, which overturned Booth in part. In Payne, the court held that there was no Eighth Amendment ban on certain types of victim impact evidence. Specifically, Payne allowed in evidence related to the personal characteristics of the victim and the emotional impact of the crimes on the victim's family. And the real sort of touchstone that Payne turned on is the idea that each victim of a crime is unique and that the loss of each victim to their family members is specific, and that it is very difficult to measure the actual harm caused by a crime if we're not going to take into account kind of the unique contours of the actual impact it had on victims. Payne also reiterated, however, that it did not disturb Booth as to other types of victim impact evidence. So specifically, the Booth prohibition on a victim's family member's characterization and opinions about the crime, the defendant, and the appropriate sentence would remain inadmissible under the Booth holding. In other words, the family is allowed to talk after Payne about the loss that they experienced and the specific characteristics of the victim, which had been lost to the world after the victim, in most cases, was murdered. But they're not allowed to weigh in on the adjudicatory function of the sentencing itself. They're not allowed to give recommendations as to what the sentence should be. They're not allowed to weigh in on the culpability of the offender. They're just allowed, after Payne, to talk about the actual loss that they suffered and the characteristics of the victim. So after Payne in 1991 kind of opened the doors, the victims' rights movement really focused on the importance of having victims be able to tell their story in open court. So victims became increasingly, after Payne, to be recognized as a kind of a stakeholder in the criminal justice process, at least in state criminal codes and codes of criminal procedure. And in a few state constitutions, there's official provision for victim impact evidence and the consideration of victims as a stakeholder in the criminal sentencing process. And in the federal context, the Crime Victims' Rights Act also affords victims the opportunity to be, quote, reasonably heard in sentencing proceedings. So it had really become an increasingly important part of the sentencing process, remained controversial, but the sort of the proliferation of victim participation in sentencing has been notable since Payne. So in Bossy v. Oklahoma, the prosecution kind of just ignored the residual prohibition of Booth, which still prohibited victims from weighing in on actual sentences and the offender himself. And the prosecution in this case actually allowed or asked three members of the murder victim's family to recommend a sentence to the jury. All three recommended the death sentence, which the jury then imposed. On appeal, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed the sentence, holding that Payne had implicitly overruled Booth's holding as to any and all forms of victim impact evidence. And this was a curiously overreaching decision, as the Court of Criminal Appeals had previously explicitly recognized that in Payne, the Supreme Court did not overrule Booth's holding as to the type of evidence that was given in this Bossy case. But they sort of took it upon themselves to declare Booth entirely overruled and allow the sentence to stand, despite the fact that it was contrary to the Booth holding. So in its per curiam opinion in October, the Supreme Court basically just reaffirmed the principle that its decisions remain binding precedent, regardless of whether subsequent cases have raised doubts about their continuing vitality. So for that reason, the court vacated and remanded, establishing that it had not, in fact, overruled the Booth case. And so the status of the law as it stands is that Booth's prohibition on certain forms of victim impact evidence remains. So there are two interesting points emerging from this small opinion. First of all, it does sort of reinforce the distinction that Payne had created between two types of victim impact evidence, which seem to turn on this concept of harm, trying to measure the full amount of harm that a criminal offense has created. Statutory provisions giving victims rights, as well as, of course, the organized victims' rights movement, think of them as stakeholders and often speak in language of sort of the restorative function of victim participation, sort of raising the victim's standing in the proceeding to the level of stakeholder, to the position of a party in some senses. I think that Payne's distinction in limiting the victim's input to information about the actual loss they suffered is sort of reaffirming that we care more about the public function of victim impact statements. In other words, the victim participating sentencing creates the space for victims to benefit themselves from telling stories about what happened, to giving their account of their narrative of their harm, which hopefully does have therapeutic functions. But the Payne distinction is really turning on the public function of criminal punishment. In other words, the public will experience harm through the harm that a crime imposes on individual citizens, and sentencing really still is about measuring that harm. I think that was kind of the core commitment of Payne, and the fact that we have the Supreme Court weighing in again on the fact that Payne has not been implicitly overruled kind of just entrenches that a bit more. The second point, it's worth noting that in a brief one-paragraph concurrence, Justice Thomas, joined by Justice Alito, notes that in vacating the decision in Bossie, the court had not actually said anything about whether Booth was in fact correctly decided and or whether Payne did in fact sweep away its analytical foundations. That suggests that there may be at least two votes on the court for revisiting Booth and potentially declaring a dead letter in light of the reasoning in Payne. But that is not where we're at today. That is perhaps a case for another day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.